From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, it's a veritable weekend preview. First, an exclusive look at a new development at the Mitchell Park Domes. Later, a positive review of the new Woody Allen film opening today.
It's an enjoyable way of escaping briefly into, you know, a world different than ours. And yet the best of these kinds of productions can tell us something about the world we live in.
Plus, five great late summer activities you can do in the comfort of your backyard.
Pack your picnic up like you're having a big adventure for the whole day. Put it in the basket. Take all the utensils you need. Don't act like you're going to your backyard. And then open the door and go to your backyard. The kids will love it.
And songs from two bands playing this weekend at Milwaukee's Irish Fest. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. This weekend, there will be more than the usual hubbub at the Mitchell Park Domes. Starting in 1964, visitors have strolled tropical fauna, desert, and, of course, the seasonal special exhibits in the third dome. This weekend marks art festival time, featuring, other than juried art, culinary delights and performers. But there is more going on that the public won't see. Over the last year and a half, a series of greenhouses have been taking shape just east of the beehive-shaped glass structures. The staff is now moving in, and so too the mums and poinsettias the team grows to perfection for upcoming display. A couple of days ago, WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz was given a behind-the-scenes peek by horticulture manager Amy Thurner as she and her team set up shop.
You have the feeling you're entering a gated community. Amy Thurner swipes me in, triggering a giant tall gate to slide open. She started tending plants as a teenager.
My first job was working in a greenhouse, so that was my first love. There's something about taking a plant from a seedling all the way into a full bloom, you know, specimen that a customer finds a lot of, you know, joy in planting in their garden. That was what interested me. So then getting to work for the parks department, and I was involved in a lot of the bed planting out in the parks, and there's a lot of satisfaction in doing those large beds.
For decades, the plants that we've seen at the domes were grown in and transported from greenhouses in Wauwatosa. But that facility was one of the casualties of the reconstructed zoo interchange. These new greenhouses have been constructions in progress for more than a year and a half. We walk into the storage prep building and up a staircase.
This is our freight elevator. It takes us down to the lower level where we were just. And this is what makes us able to bring in our shipment of soil. That's the biggest thing we have to get up.
They go through lots and lots of soil.
This is the horticulturist's office.
It's Mary Brownrider's job to figure out what and how many will be planted in that soil. We find her poring over catalogs and computer lists at her desk. She's in the middle of placing orders
with all these different seed companies, plug companies, for all the different shows. We plan them way ahead.
Like how far ahead?
I'm working right now a little bit on this holiday show, the next winter train show of 2015, the spring show of 2015, the summer show of 2015, and the front circle bed outside for 2015.
Brownrider works with a broker to purchase starter plants called plugs from greenhouses all over the place, as she puts it. Purchasing seeds, she says, is much simpler to manage.
I can just order from the seed companies myself.
So what kind of things do you order from seed?
All the annuals, like easy things like Dusty Miller and some other plants are a little more difficult, so we get them from plugs. Or they just do better from plugs.
Brownrider came to the domes by way of a 14-year stint at Berner Botanical Gardens. As for her skills, she credits her mom, who was a bang-up houseplant grower.
And then my mother-in-law was totally into outdoor gardening with perennials, and I just
got it from all sides.
Yeah.
After years of working with plants outside, Brownrider is learning to grow them under glass. We find Clay Goss, the newest horticulturist of the bunch, rummaging around a storage room, trying to find a suit to fit his tall frame. That is a protective suit. Gus is about to apply pesticides to a sea of mum plants. Gus, an Appleton, Wisconsin native, says he fell into horticulture. During college at the University of Minnesota, a friend suggested he check out a plant propagation course. Wham! Goss says he was hooked. How did he land this job?
I didn't know anybody. Actually, I had just graduated. I was working landscaping and another job at the time. And my mom actually found the job online for me. And, you know, I sent in
Mom.
Yeah, exactly. I sent in my resume and then went through a few interviews and whatnot, and it seemed to be the right place, so, yeah.
Gus is buzzing with excitement. Since joining the team, he has spent most of his time programming the sophisticated system critical to the greenhouse operation. It orchestrates everything from watering to fertilizing to when the mum plants require extended darkness. Today, Gus is stepping into the greenhouses.
This will actually be the first time that I'd spray pesticides, but I'd be working with a guy that's been doing it for 30-some years.
That's horticulturist Chris Garr, the humblest of men, it seems. 3 decades under his belt, Garr is void of pretense and simply calls himself
one of the horts. Seeding, growing, we start all the stuff here.
Manager Amy Thurner says Garr is a master.
Through the head house here. We'll
she steers me toward the greenhouses to show me proof of it. Along the way, we run into another team member, Marion French. She spends her time tending the arid dome plants.
What's your day-to-day in the desert?
Well, sometimes it's actually watering, which a lot of people, you know, when they see me watering, they're a little confused. But, I mean, it can be a lot of weeding, a lot of pruning cactus, planting new cactus or new annuals, you know. So it's all kinds of different stuff. It's like a garden, just really prickly.
French is ferrying some man-made decorative barrel cacti toward her desert.
They came from an artist that I think was from Arizona, but I met him at the state fair. There's another one I just put in that's a saguaro cactus with the two arms and flowers. It's gorgeous. It'll be an inspiration for my baby saguaros.
There's an infectious, I love my job here vibration in this place. But Thurner says they take their jobs very seriously. Their core crops are poinsettias and mums. We pass through glass doors, mostly covered with cardboard, into a mum greenhouse. It's a sea of regal plants, perfectly spaced so they don't bump into one another as they grow.
So our mums are always grown in 2 crops because the flowering only lasts for as long as they last, and then we have to do a replacement. So this is the first replacement. These are the ones that we do the blackout cloth for, so we're shading the roof and the sides because they need an extended period of darkness to initiate flowering so they're ready for the show. Hence the cardboard on the door. We're just trying to block out the light from the hallway.
The plants look like they're hooked up to life support systems. They each have individual watering and nutrition lines.
They all got other irrigation tubes in them.
Oh my gosh.
And it's very nice that they all have enough room and they're not touching, because once this starts to happen, then they're not uniform anymore and they become distorted and don't look really professional or show ready. So we need all the space we can get to make this nice round form.
Clay and Chris shuffle in, wearing their white protective suits.
So they're going to be treating this greenhouse for aphids. So our crop is very healthy and doing very well, but aphids is a very common greenhouse pest, especially on mums. So it's, you know, every crop has its pest that it's most prone for. And mums would be aphids, sometimes a spider mite. If we're talking about poinsettias, Chris will always be fighting whitefly.
As far as Thurner is concerned, it's the dome's poinsettias used in the holiday floral show that puts her team a notch above many others.
These really make the Christmas show. This is, to me, what makes us very unique, is being able to do something that's more of like a floral poinsettia. It's not something that you buy at Home Depot or Lowe's or anywhere. These are very unique.
The plants they're nurturing now arrive just after the 4th of July.
We all are off on the 4th, enjoying ourselves, and we come back to work and fill pots like crazy people and get ready for the poinsettias. It's a very long crop.
Some are raised to be straights, tall plants with impressive flowers at the top.
So all of this all comes off.
Oh,
and so
gosh.
What we're basically doing is forcing the plant to put all of its energy into the flower.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
Just becoming tall and straight.
Okay, so this plant, when it's all said and done, will be about 2.5-3 feet tall. Stems will be even thicker, and the flower will just be huge.
Others are pinched back early to bush. Thurner calls the results horticulturist Chris Garr's magic.
He's been growing these plants for, 30 years, so he grows the most beautiful poinsettias I've ever seen. He's got it down, so Clay is learning everything from him.
Thurner's so busy with what's above ground, I have to remind her to tell me about the huge storage tanks built into the system to capture thousands of gallons of rainwater. That, too, is programmed into the greenhouse maintenance system.
There's 4 20,000-gallon storage tanks buried underground. They're between greenhouse 6 and storage prep, so we have a capacity of 80,000. That's one of the sources for all the irrigation happening on the greenhouses. So we can either pull from that, concentrated fertilizer solution, and then each house has its own, we call dosatron. That would be for an individual specialized fertilizer chemical application for that zone.
Does that rainwater have to be treated in any way?
Yeah, we use a UV light to sanitize it.
Although they couldn't be closer neighbors, dome visitors won't automatically be invited into the greenhouses. Thurner says the utmost care must be taken to keep their plants disease-free. But she admits there's more than one reason she's delighted to live right next door to the domes. For years, she helped grow plants at the Watertown Plank Road greenhouses. They'd be shipped over by truck, and few people realized where the beautiful creatures came from. Now visitors are beginning to make the connection.
Okay, so for me, that is really rewarding, so people are starting to make that connection. You don't just wave a wand and have all the beautiful flowers. Like, we do that all ourselves here.
Every once in a while, visitors will see Thurner and her crew ferrying in new plants through the amply sized breezeway that connects her world to the domes. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Benz.
Amy Thurner is horticulture manager at the Mitchell Park Domes. She gave Susan Benz the behind-the-scenes look at the facility's new greenhouse. This weekend marks the annual Domes Art Festival, which runs today through Sunday. We'll take a trip not far away to Mitchell Street with our weekly installment of the series Listening to Mitchell a little later in the show. Next up, though, film critic Dave Lurson joins us to talk about three movies opening today at a theater near you. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. We're giving you lots of options for a summer weekend on today's show. If the rain in the forecast has you diving for the cover of indoor activities, our film contributor Dave Lurson joins Lake Effect's Dan Harmon with a look at three movies opening today. Later, they'll take on Calvary, starring Brendan Gleeson, and also the lighthearted Land Ho. But they start today with the latest in director Woody Allen's series of European films called Magic in the Moonlight.
With his latest European set piece, Magic in the Moonlight, Woody Allen pulls off a remarkable feat by folding an essay on metaphysics into a glamorously entertaining package. Magic in the Moonlight evokes a bygone era, staging the 1920s as a lavish period piece worthy of masterpiece theater, complete with gleaming motor cars, flapper fashion, and jazz dance bands. These kinds of things are a big part of the pleasure of what we can just call the masterpiece theater genre. I mean, you know, it's an enjoyable way of escaping briefly into, you know, a world different than ours. And yet the best of these kinds of productions can tell us something about the world we live in by bringing up points in a way that maybe we wouldn't pay as much attention to if they were set in the everyday that we live in.
Is the script in any way new ground for Woody Allen, just the concept of a I don't know, an illusionist trying to debunk another illusionist?
Well, I don't know if he's ever done that before, but the basic themes of magic and the moonlight have been with him throughout his career. The whole idea of grappling with the nature of reality and finding a way to do it in ways that are either funny oftentimes or entertaining, putting this into the form of a two-hour movie. How often is Nietzsche cited in a movie nowadays or in any days? So, yeah, I mean, these are perennial Woody Allen themes. Is there anything beyond the material world we live in? And if there is nothing beyond that, would we be better off just thinking that there is because we would be happier for it? And then what about things like love? I mean, love is not a material thing. We can't measure it or weigh it. Doesn't have any impact in the test tubes of a laboratory. But we all know what it feels like. So these are perennial Woody Allen themes that he has revisited over and over again. And this time he chose the form of a Houdini-like magician, psychic, debunker, a kind of British version of Houdini, if you will, who sets forth to disprove the psychic claims of a woman played by Emma Stone, who may very well be a gold digger looking for some to attach herself to the family fortune of an expatriate family in the south of France.
Woody Allen wrote this script, correct?
Yes.
To me, it just seemed so different from his other types of movies. I mean, his other European-based movies, we could say, well, it's sort of like him transplanting the New York ethos into just a new European location. Well, this one just seemed different than those previous scripts.
Well, he's done a lot of movies set in periods of the past, particularly earlier in the 20th century. Woody Allen has a fascination for the era of his childhood, I suppose, or the era right before his childhood. I mean, we get a sense of this in his great film from a couple of years ago, the Midnight in Paris movie, where a person besotted with that particular era finds himself being transported back in time and meeting some of the key artistic figures of Paris in the 1920s. So in a way, in the 1920s, there we go again. I mean, he has been, Woody Allen, a kind of time traveler as a director, usually maintaining a version of the Woody Allen sensibility, regardless of whether his films are in the present, in the past, or in one or two occasions like Sleeper from the 1970s in the future.
And despite the San Francisco location of one of his recent movies, is he going to continue this European tour?
Well, I think he's really enjoying doing this. I remember reading somewhere that he was planning a movie set in Prague, which would make sense, great scenery, probably relatively inexpensive to make movies there. And that's one of the things that's motivating him, too, is the expense of it all. He's finding it easier to find money or to pay for movie making in locations other than his traditional New York City setting. But it's been extremely healthy for him as an artist to get out of Manhattan. I can't think of the name of this movie now. It was the one bad movie he did in the past 10, 12 years. It was the one movie that was set entirely in New York and came out about 4 or 5 years ago. Luckily, he went back to Europe afterward because he was very much, by the end of the 20th century, exhausting the New York setting and the themes he could derive from those kinds of characters.
Any last parting thoughts on Magic in the Moonlight?
Well, I think it's a fun movie. You don't have to, be interested in philosophy to enjoy this movie. But if you are, you'll find another level of engagement.
Well, let's change from a pretty lighthearted movie, if you will, to something that's less so, and that's Calvary.
Yes, this is a movie that looks at the grim condition of the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland today after all of the revelations of pedophilia in the priesthood and abusive power by church authorities over many decades. Here we are, Brendan Gleeson, a very fine actor, playing a good priest, a Catholic priest who is attuned to the most positive elements of that faith and tradition. And he finds himself confronted by something very strange, a man that he knows, a parishioner, in his confession booth, announcing that he had been abused as a child by a priest and that he's going to kill Father James, Brendan Gleeson, not because Brendan Gleeson never did anything wrong, but because he never did. It would be more meaningful to kill a good priest than simply to kill another bad priest.
I guess I had some trouble with the premise of this movie. Maybe if it just seems like it's taking on such an enormous issue, and there's a lot of stories that don't seem to tie together to me, and maybe it's so ambitious to try to tackle this kind of issue in a kind of a dramatic movie.
Well, I think, you know, the movie could be criticized from a number of angles. I found it to be an enigmatic film, which appealed to me. We don't really understand why Father James didn't simply go to the police and say, so-and-so, I know who this person is. He threatened to kill me a week from Sunday. Can you talk to him about this? Can you maybe, you know, give me some police protection? Why can't I just, you know, move for a while, you know, get out of town for a couple of weeks till things, you know, maybe be transferred entirely out of there if there's somebody out to get you? But he seems very fatalistic. One interpretation, you know, that came to my mind was that he sees himself after a point as a kind of sacrifice for all the sins and misdeeds of the institution that he represents. So that's a possibility. But he, of course, is a very different sort of Roman Catholic priest. He had been married. He has a grown daughter. He has grappled with areas of reality that his colleagues in the priesthood, who don't come across very well in the film, you know, he's far superior to them. And yet he seems resigned to the possibility of an early death because of things that he himself had nothing directly to do with.
I might just make a suggestion here. If you're going to watch this movie, to maybe if you're not following the events of the Catholic Church in Ireland or the Irish Parliament in relation to the Catholic Church, you might want to just do a little research to get an idea of how pervasive this mindset is in Ireland.
Right. But I would say that the parallels between Ireland and Milwaukee are very striking. I mean, many of the same things that happened here in Milwaukee are alluded to in the movie. So you have a priest, you know, doing heinous misdeeds, and he's transferred elsewhere. I mean, we the same charges have been brought against the Archdiocese of Milwaukee during the 60s and 70s, and before that time, the same kinds of references occur in this film pertaining to Ireland. So really, in the way, you know, there and here, the gap is not that enormous.
I would contend it is bigger, just because the Catholic Church is way more influential in Ireland. I mean, it's part of the culture and has been for a very long time. So that's what I don't think this movie really wrapped its ambition around is that it's such a huge part of culture there that the split is enormous. You know.
Right. Well, I think it does touch on that because Father James is confronted with a world of a parish, even in a rural place, that no longer accords the same respect to this institution. It's quite obvious as he goes about his rounds that people are sort of putting up with it out of habit, maybe in some cases, rather than embracing it fully in light of everything that has come out in the past decade or so. And yeah, of course, Ireland, the Irish Republic, you know, was founded very much on Catholic ethos and in tandem with the Catholic hierarchy.
All right. Well, let's move on to something a little less serious, the movie Land Ho.
Well, Land Ho is a comedy, I guess, about two older gentlemen off on a kind of odd couple buddy vacation in Iceland. And I would not really want to spend an hour and a half of my time with these two people. There were some amusing moments, but not enough of them. I was left very disinterested in it. It was like a series of run-on conversations that just, you know, I didn't really, you know, find interesting to listen to.
Were you waiting for something to happen that never did?
I kind of suspected that nothing was going to happen in this movie particularly. I mean, a few things happened. I mean, you know, the idea of a journey of exploration, finding yourself in the company of an old friend in an unusual location. I mean, we've, you know, seen many movies like that before. This one, for me, just didn't quite work. Was it because not enough happened? Was it because I found the good old boy Southern character played by Erwin Nelson to be more obnoxious than intriguing? I don't know. But it's one of those movies where I know that I'm never going to go back and see it a second time because there just was not enough there for me. Sometimes, a movie that strikes me as kind of a C-plus, B-minus movie if I were grading them, I'm tempted to go back and see it again, and maybe I'll see something the second time through that I missed the first time. But here it just left me so disinterested that I think I'll skip the DVD or the Netflix release when it happens.
Do you think that it has any merit just as a kind of lighthearted summer road trip movie?
Well, the scenery is beautiful. I mean, I enjoyed seeing Iceland. I mean, I guess, yeah, it takes you out of your environment. I mean, as we said about Magic in the Moonlight, yes, there is always value into escaping for an hour and a half or 2 hours into a different place, one that's more beautiful or more intriguing or more interesting. And yes, Iceland, I think, plays that role for me and maybe many other people. But I just wish that something better had happened during that hour and a half in that lovely setting.
Okay, enough said. Thanks for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor at the Shepherd Express weekly newspaper and author of It's I Hate Hollywood blog. He's also our regular film contributor. And he spoke with Dan Harmon about Land Ho, Calvary, and Magic in the Moonlight, all opening today. Keep listening. After the break, our outdoor adventure contributors join us with some things you can do close to home. Really close to home. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. We're doing sort of an improvised weekend preview this morning on the show. Before the break, our film contributor joined us with some current movie offerings, and a little later in the show, we'll hear songs from a couple of bands playing at this weekend's Irish Fest on the lakefront. But if you'd rather have some fun closer to home, say literally in your backyard, we're joined this morning by our outdoor adventure contributors, Ken Keffer and Stacey Tornio, who have some ideas for late summer activities in a backyard near you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Hey there.
So we've got a little bit of summer left in front of us, and maybe as those lazy days are beginning to wane, we might want to try to squeeze in a few more activities. And you are coming to us with five great activities, which are not just great, but are great and free.
Yes, they are. We'll start out with number one, which is fireflies. That is absolutely – anyone can get into fireflies. It doesn't matter how old you are. Ken from Wyoming didn't have a lot of fireflies growing up, right?
So we had friends who visited from California once, specifically at the time of year when the fireflies were supposed to be here, and and they didn't time it right that year. But yeah, I guess fireflies are not really a thing in the West.
No. The first time I saw fireflies, I was, well into my 20s, and I had that enthusiasm of like a second grader running around and catching them, and I put them in the little jar, and I poked little holes in the top, and I let them go at the end of the night, just like you're supposed to.
So who knew we had such a gem right here in Wisconsin?
And really, it's a good chance to learn what bioluminescence is all about.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, for sure. The really cool thing about fireflies for me, is that each species has their own kind of firefly flash. And so there could be different species out there. And there's some – this is so cool. They'll flash – which will attract the other fireflies, only instead of bringing them in to mate with, they're actually predators, and they'll eat the other ones. So cool. The ultimate bait and switch.
I love it.
It's like a nature show in your own backyard.
Yes.
Okay, so fireflies, that's usually a good late afternoon, early evening on into nighttime activity. Cloud watching is something that is not as good at nights.
Yeah, so we have two that is perfect for getting a blanket out. So get a blanket or a quilt, and the first one is cloud watching. And actually, you could combine these, and the next one is having a backyard picnic. So, you know, pack your picnic up like you're having a big adventure for the whole day. Put it in the basket. Take all the utensils you need. Don't act like you're going to your backyard. And then open the door and go to your backyard. The kids will love it. And then after you're done eating your picnic, just lay down and start looking at the clouds, see what animal shapes you can see out there. That never gets old.
I totally saw a monkey riding a Harley Davidson in the clouds the other day.
Well, and maybe this is not intentionally related, but if you're finishing up your backyard picnic and you don't put it away right away, you could also very easily have a bug hunt.
Exactly. That's another one. That's number four on our list, bug hunt. Again, all you need is kind of related to the fireflies is if you want to take a closer look at them is a jar. Don't forget to poke the holes in the top so they can breathe. But you can find some pretty incredible bugs just in your own backyard.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things that we, you know, encourage folks to do, they're pretty simple activities. But kids, I mean, this is curiosity at its finest, you know, and just turn the kids loose and be like, go explore the flowers and see what you can find, you know, roll a log over and explore the entire ecosystem underneath it and stuff. And so, yeah, it's just building that curiosity.
Yeah, one of the things we challenge kids with whenever we meet them and we say, go and find one new animal, discover one new animal. And to them, that just seems like that's impossible. Like, I know all the animals. And so then we always tell them bugs. Like, you do not know all the bugs in your backyard because there's just way too many of them. And so bugs are an excellent way to just, like, start exploring. Like Ken said, lift a rock, you know, roll over a log and get a closer look.
How about one more free backyard activity this summer?
One of my favorites is going to be a build a fort or a tent, you know. So take that picnic blanket, pitch that thing into a little fort, you know, whether it's some chairs you can pile up and drape it over. You can hang it up and off the fence like a little lean-to style. There's different ways. Again, I mean, just turn the kids loose, give them some clothespins, some sheets, and be like, there you go. Go build your tent for the day and hours of fun.
Yeah, and kind of an alternative to that is if you already have a tent and maybe you tried backyard camping, leave that tent up. The kids will love going in there. It can be their little reading nook. You know, they can have an activity. But leave the tent up for a week. You know, it's put the rain fly on. If it rains, who cares? And, you know, let them use that as like a little fort for a while.
Well, and what's neat about all five of these things, you could bang them all out in one day, or you could spread it out over a week or even the rest of the summer.
Yeah, you could. Make that list. Start checking things off, right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, these are just like iconic things that you should do every year, you know, and it'll be part of childhood. You look back and be like, oh, yeah, fireflies. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Building my fort.
Well, I better get to it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are creators of the website DestinationNature.net and the authors of the Kids Outdoor Adventure book, 448 Great Things to Do in Nature Before You Grow Up. And they are also our regular Outdoor Adventure contributors. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here is this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's seven blocks from the Modjeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we're sharing the voices and sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
Perhaps a cultural shock?
It was 2000. I was a seminarian. I was a missionary. My flight got delayed. We were waiting and waiting and waiting in Chicago. Was, you know what? What's going on, man? You gotta help me out. I need to go to Milwaukee. He told me that, and I didn't know how to use a phone. There were no flights. The last shuttle that night is leaving now. So you either take it or you have to stay. I only had one business card that I was like, will you tell me where I had to get off? And then the bus dropped me off at the airport. He said, call a taxi. Where do I drop you off? I said, I don't know, somewhere. I'll wait for you because this neighborhood is not very good. He waited for me. And nobody opened, so I was throwing snow to the windows up on the second floor because I saw some light. I'm here. So they opened the doors and they let me in. Well, the next morning, I was kind of furious to know that I almost got lost and that he didn't bother to worry about me. But I think I come from a culture where people are very caring and they show their concern. And I think here it's like, you do it on your own. Mm-hmm. So I was like the first slap on the face and saying, you know, learn the culture here, I suppose. I arrived, I didn't have any money. I had $25 in my pocket. I had a sweater that I was wearing, a couple of shirts and two pair of pants and three books, like an encyclopedia with all the philosophers in there. And I've been always fascinated by books. And these were the first books I was able to buy. After doing some missionary work, and people had donated money to me. So these are very dear to me because I spent many hours studying them and preparing. And I think philosophy gives the mind a structure to understand the world. These books were like a treasure. I had everything I needed in these three books.
Listening to Mitchell is a public art project by Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr. To learn more about Listening to Mitchell events and happenings, you'll find a link from wuwm.com/Lake Effect. And don't forget, you can hear the next radio installment in the series next Friday on Lake Effect. One last break and then some music from two groups playing at Irish Fest this weekend, both recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee's Irish Fest, which gets underway in earnest today, is very obviously a celebration of Irish music and culture. But the festival always features bands that, while having much in common with Irish music, come from other distinct traditions. A case in point is Searson. The band is from Canada's Ottawa Valley, which hugs the border of Ontario and Quebec. At the heart of the group are sisters Erin and Colleen Searson, who explain the Ottawa Valley's distinctive step dancing and musical traditions.
There definitely is a very specific Ottawa Valley sound, especially with the style of fiddling and definitely the step dancing, which we unfortunately can't show you this morning. And I think what we've done is we grew up with it, my sister and I, and then we've kind of taken what we've learned from this Ottawa Valley style of fiddling and dancing and incorporated it into our own with our songwriting and expanded from there.
Well, okay, so when you talk about specific styles of fiddling, this might be invisible to a lot of people who are maybe only casual fans of traditional music. How do you describe where Ottawa Valley fiddling comes in versus any other kind of traditional fiddling?
That's an excellent question for this early in the morning. Ottawa Valley fiddling does have its own unique style. It seems like when we're down in the States, most people can associate it with Irish Celtic fiddling. But when we play in Canada, it's very closely associated with Cape Breton style, East Coast fiddling. And I think Ottawa Valley fiddling has a mixture East Coast, Irish, and Quebecois fiddling, French fiddling. It's kind of all blended together. It's almost a feeling of the way we play, where we accent. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a feeling.
I wonder if it's like the musical equivalent of a dialect.
Yes, that's a very good way to say it.
Very good.
Okay, and so we've talked about the Ottawa Valley style of fiddling. Where does Ottawa Valley step dancing come in the bigger context of step dancing as a whole?
Again, a type of dialect for sure. It originated from the Quebec logging camps. And so that style where the men would dance at night in their boots for entertainment. And so our area is very specific. We have clickers, loose clickers on our shoes. We use our arms. They're up in the air. Very different from, say, Irish dance where they're very straight, arms down by their side. So it's a definite – and we move. We jump a lot and kick our legs up. So there's a lot of movement, which is very specific for the Ottawa Valley.
But while tradition is a key part of the group's music, seven CDs into the band's career, they are writing all their own songs, such as this song called Honey from their latest CD.
Honey, I know you've been crying. Your cheeks are red and your eyes are swollen. There ain't nothing I wouldn't do for you. Honey, you stare so serious. Wondered how I could be so oblivious. Well, everything is new and its beauty shines for you. Shines for you. Shines for you. And the whole world's spinning for you. Forever pulled towards you. I am here for you. And I will never leave you. I will never leave you. Dignity to see you smile, you smile, you smile, and the whole world's spinning for you, forever pulled towards you. I am here for you, and I will.
Searson is sisters Aaron and Colleen Searson, along with Dano O'Shea and Fraser Gauthier. They'll play shows today, tomorrow, and Sunday at Irish Fest in Milwaukee. Also on the bill is another newcomer to the festival. Dallahan is based in Edinburgh, but only one of the members is even from Scotland. The group met playing sessions around that city and late last year decided to formalize things and form a band. Thomas O'Brien and Jack Badcock are Irish. Fiddler Yanni Lang is from Hungary. Kieran Ryan is the one Scottish member of the group. They joined Bonnie North in Studio C1. We'll hear a full interview in the weeks to come. But for now, here they are with a live studio version of a track from their brand new CD.
We're going to play a song now called Carrica Reed, which we believe is written by Cathy Ryan. And it's just a nice wee love song. And we've kind of Dallahanified it a wee bit, you know, stuck in a couple of our own riffs and bits and bobs. So I hope you enjoy this one.
I'll walk the miles from Ballintoy, no shining moon to light my way across across the fields of Larry Bane, the road bridge where my love lays. The fishermen lie in their beds, salmon spawn on Moyle's blue sea, and you lie there upon the grass, waiting for me on Carrigaree. One step and step, hold tight, let me go. 24, hold me tight, let me go. I'm nearly there, let me go, let me go. I will find you where you lie, stealing soft under your coat, and we will tell our sing our songs out every note. One step and two step, hold tight, let me go. 24, hold me tight, let me go. I'm nearly there, let me go, let me go.
Dallahan performing in Lake Effect Studio C1. They'll play shows all weekend at Irish Fest in Milwaukee. There is a schedule and all three songs they played for us at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Our live recordings were engineered by our studio engineer, John Strelecki, to whom we give much thanks, along with our whole production team, including Dan Harmon and Bonnie North, plus Eleanor Peterson, Audrey Nowakowski, and Brooke Dowden. I'm Mitch Tyke. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, and I sure hope we'll be a part of it. Thanks so much for tuning in, and do join us tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.